Welcome to Aspire, Arch Street Public Radio, broadcasting interviews from our international Innovate podcast series. Here's your host, David M. Castro.
Hello, and welcome to Innovate Podcast. Today, our guest is Dr. David Ross, President and CEO of the Task Force for Global Health. The Task Force is an international nonprofit organization dedicated to improving health conditions for vulnerable populations around the world. We'll be talking today about the award-winning efforts of the Task Force to control and eliminate disease while building systems that protect and promote health. Dr. Ross assumed leadership of the Task Force in 2016 after many years as director of its Public Health Informatics Institute. 2016 was a big year for the Task Force, a worldwide recognition as winner of the Humanitarian Award from the Conrad Hilton Foundation. Dr. Ross is a thought leader and one of the pioneers of public health informatics. He was founding director of the CDC's first national initiative to improve information infrastructure for public health in the United States. Before joining the task force, Dr. Ross held leadership, administrative, and corporate consultant roles with the U.S. Public Health Service, a private hospital system in Maryland, and one of the largest health information technology firms. Dr. Ross has earned a Doctor of Science degree in operations research from the Johns Hopkins University and a Bachelor of Science degree in aerospace engineering from the University of Colorado. Dr. Ross, I want to thank you so much for joining our conversation today on Innovate Podcast.
Hey, well, thanks for having me.
I'd really like to begin with your early life and ask you, you know, when you were growing up, did you ever imagine that you would be doing the kind of work that you do today?
A simple answer, no. I grew up in Wyoming as kind of a ranch kid and could never have expected that I would move from a very rural, frontierish existence to big city life working around the globe.
In retrospect, do you see family, faith, or community relationships or inspirations that, looking backward, you could say inspired you on this journey?
Yeah, absolutely. On the family side, certainly my father played a big role just because he stressed so heavily that you should get to know people and assume people are good until they prove otherwise and respect the dignity of all people. It was just very important for him that we did that. And whether, regardless of what our job career was about, was just about, he was very big on making sure that we respected all people, regardless of station in life, because he had come from extreme poverty and didn't believe that there should be any divide in class. So that certainly was a sort of an overlay influence. And later, when I was actually a missile engineer, had the unusual experience of being able to get to know Dr. Abe Lilienfeld, who was the chair of the epidemiology department at Johns Hopkins University. And he gave me a vision, and that was about how you can do things that impact the health of whole populations of people. And that vision propelled me towards the career I'm in today.
So was it really, was that in while you were in graduate school that you made that connection?
Well, no, it's actually before that. I was actually an aerospace engineer at the Hopkins Applied Physics Lab working on missiles. But I was doing strategic nuclear missile work. While it is about, in theory, the defense of the country, it's also about the potential destruction of mankind. And that bothered me a lot. You remember the days of the Cold War and mutually assured destruction strategy. It's like the communists won't get us, but we will succeed by killing everybody. That weighed heavily on me and was thinking about moving towards something, a different career direction. And Dr. Lilienfeld laid out this idea of populations of health and the impact on populations. And whether that meant go to graduate school or medical school, there was a career in doing something that could, where your actions could affect many. And that was, to me, a wildly intriguing idea and led me to go to graduate school at Hopkins and on into public health.
Interesting. It's so always amazing to me the different twists and turns that a career can take and how the people that we meet end up shaping our futures. Mm-hmm. I know that you're a huge advocate of the idea that healthcare, that information management is central to good outcomes in healthcare and in public health. And I'm feeling that our listeners probably will not have a very strong sense of what even the phrase health informatics means. And I think it would be really helpful if you could both tell us what you think of when you think of health informatics. What does that mean to a person who maybe is hearing it for the first time? And then also tell us a little bit about how you became interested in this. I know it'll probably be a continuation of the story that you just started to tell us, but it really is a fascinating field, and I imagine it has something to do also with the emergence of information technology as such a dominant force in the culture. But I would love to hear you speak generally about that.
Sure. Yeah, most people don't know the word informatics. It is not a very warm, fuzzy word. It's actually a word I think the British came up with, and it found its way here. To put it very simply, this is all about putting the right facts, the right data in front of the right decision makers at the right time so that the decisions they make, whether those are about an individual and individual care or whether it's about decisions that might affect entire populations of people, are the most informed decisions possible. So think right data, right time, right person. How do you do that? You're right, Dave, that this is a field that emerged because of the emerging information technology revolution. It made possible things that weren't possible before. And I mean, that's how progress goes. And that's, in fact, how the whole field of public health exists. Certain technologies like a vaccine get invented, and all of a sudden you have a reason to have vaccine programs in health agencies. The same with information technologies. The question is, how can you use these technologies to put the right information in front of people? There is the world of medical informatics, which is principally about using these technologies to support the processes of care, and now more and more to be actually an aid to, not a hindrance, to clinicians as they give care. And in the very short near term, you're going to see much more in the way of computer decision support and ultimately artificial intelligence in using these technologies to support providers in giving care. On the public health side, what you need to think about are whole populations. Most people in the U.S. have heard of the Centers for Disease Control, this unusual agency that exists here in Atlanta, Georgia, that is charged with helping state, local public health agencies and now ministers of health around the world to detect and respond to and to prepare for diseases and threats to health. The CDC is the premier agency for looking at the threats to health and how to respond. But every state, local public health agency also does that. And they are the ones that here in the U.S. who are primarily responsible if there is a major health problem. So what people need is information. Now, let me give you a simple example. When there's a flu outbreak, what do people want to know? Well, they want to know if it's coming to their city. If so, when? If it's a novel flu, think back a few years ago when we had the H1N1 virus, flu variant. That was a new variant, which meant many, many people were not protected because of prior vaccinations. That meant that the likelihood of more people getting sick went up significantly. And if it was a virulent form of the disease, meaning if you've got it, you might get very, very sick and or increase your odds of dying. That kind of pandemic threat needs information. It needs the information about who's getting sick, who's showing up at an emergency department, how many, where. So it's disease over time and place. But with modern technologies, we have the opportunity to make that precise to your town, your neighborhood. And in the information-rich society we now live in, it is the expectation of the public and elected officials that they will have those answers. And this is the challenge to public health, is how to put that kind of information in front of people at the granular level in a timely way that actually helps them make decisions that have consequence.
So looking at the current work of the task force, which is just breathtaking in terms of its impact, and we can certainly understand why you were recognized with this award in 2016. It's interesting to see how information and the management of information is so central to the work that you're really doing around the world. And I think, again, this is an area where, unfortunately, the average American has very little understanding of the enormous disparities in health outcomes between Americans and other people around the world. And I think, you know, your work there at the task force is such a powerful way of introducing people to some of those differences. Just the idea of extending strategies that are available, medicines that are available to treat diseases that cause so much suffering. So I'd like to talk with you a little bit through that work. It's obviously an illustration of health equity, which I know is something near and dear to your heart and central to the mission of the task force. But I thought it would be great to start with neglected tropical diseases, which, again, I think if I walked out in the street and said, what are neglected tropical diseases, most people would have no idea what we're talking about. And yet when you hear about it, things like river blindness and trachoma, I guess, is another one. Talk to our listeners a little bit about that. I think they will find it fascinating.
Sure. Yes, it's a term of art, actually, which isn't all that helpful, because saying neglected tropical disease doesn't convey a lot to anybody other than an expert. This is an area of infectious diseases and parasitic diseases. There are a handful of these diseases that fall under this umbrella term, neglected tropical diseases. There are about 20 of them in total. And of that 20, about 5 diseases are treatable through drugs alone. That if you administer drugs, you can mediate or eliminate the effects of the disease if you've been infected. Mm. And you can also, if you treat large populations of people, eventually drive down the prevalence of the disease to a level that you effectively have eliminated it. So this organization has the unusual good fortune of being the place that began a partnership with Merck Drug Company back in technically began 1987, a program to treat a disease called onchocerciasis. The general name is called river blindness, but it's a disease, it's a parasite that is spread by a fly that bites you, and in the course of biting you, injects the parasite, gets into your bloodstream, goes to your skin, you start itching like crazy, and then ultimately, not only are you incredibly uncomfortable and itch to where you bleed, it eventually goes to your eyes and causes blindness. So it was a terrible disease, but it was a disease that existed only in tropical areas of fast-running water. You tend to think of tropical areas and swamps, but actually, if you think of the mountainous areas across the tropics of Americas and Central and South America and Africa, there's where this parasite can breed. And the people who live in these regions typically have been very poor people living indigenous lifestyles. And so there was little recognition paid in the developing world about this condition. And it took a Merck scientist, Dr. Roy Campbell, who actually, for his discovery, received a Nobel Prize 5-6 years ago. But he was the guy who figured out that they had a drug, a veterinary drug, that could cure this parasite. And they did some clinical trials and determined that they had a drug that was effectively wholly safe and 100% effective. So it was a very rare situation. And they came to the founder of our organization, Dr. Bill Fahey, and showed him the data from their clinical trials, and together they agreed to launch what has now become the field of pharmacophilanthropy, where Merck made a commitment to give as much drug as needed for as long as needed to treat this disease. originally the idea was to try to mitigate the damage and limit the number of people that suffered. So it was a control program. Today we are turning the corner. It is now an elimination program. We are moving close to that point, 5, maybe 10 years from now, when the world will be rid of this disease. And that's because there has been this massive web of partners working together in many, many places, many countries, over many years, to treat millions of people repeatedly in a way that led to the elimination of this parasite.
Amazing story, and your organization as the catalyst of that process. I think it's something I would hope that our listeners would step back for a minute and think about this, because, you know, we live in a world where all we hear about is bad news. We don't celebrate enough the extraordinary, courageous collaboration that takes place that could eliminate so much suffering around the world. It's just an amazing story. And also to recognize that some of our major corporate forces, that they do have a heart for the community and are willing to step up and put their resources to work for people, it's something that could lift your spirits. I'm hearing about that. Just knowledgeable about the time that we have, I'd also love for you to talk a little bit about these other two domains. And I know that there are, I want to encourage our listeners to go to your website and see, because that's just one of the diseases, right? There's others that you're working on that are equally damaging.
We work on leprosy. We work on blinding trachoma. That's a bacterial infection. Leprosy is actually caused by a bacteria. As I mentioned, the Mectazan donation program, it's called, that's river blindness. And then lymphatic filariasis, some people may know as elephantiasis, where people's legs swell up, another infectious disease we treat, as well as intestinal worms, major burden in parts of the world that actually impairs the growth and development of kids and has lifelong impact. So if you can get rid of those intestinal worms, you actually open the opportunity for people to become prosperous adults. So we work in a cluster of those diseases, and the model is essentially the same, where we work with corporate pharma partners, Merck, Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer. Pfizer donates literally billions of dollars a year worth of drugs for this program. So these are all companies that have big social impact and are very responsible. The other area we do is vaccine preventable diseases. So we have programs like our partnership for influenza vaccine introduction called PIVI. It's basically a program where we work with countries that do not have routine flu vaccination programs and help introduce vaccine, largely through donated vaccines, but to help them build a national flu vaccination program that reaches all people. That's the equity side of this. Over time, that transfers to them taking it on their own shoulders. And we have, in the case of Laotian Republic, they are now graduating out of being a country to which we donated the flu vaccine, to running their own national program. So we're helping countries help themselves through vaccine preventable diseases. And we will soon be launching a global effort on hepatitis C and B elimination. These are big, all of these are big programs. We treat in the hundreds of millions of people a year. And then this is all done in a way, as you said at the outset, in a way to strengthen health systems. And that means we help both build the workforce to make sure that you have well-trained, credentialed, properly trained doctors and nurses and pharmacists and technicians, but also epidemiologists. So we run a global program in field epidemiology training, very similar to the CDC's Epidemic Intelligence Service program that creates the people who ultimately become state health officials in the U.S. So we're doing that around the world, and the Informatics Institute helping states in the U.S. and countries around the world build the information capacity to inform decisions.
That's a great approach, I think, if I'm hearing you right, that the idea is, you know, not just to perform these essentially rescue operations, but also then to increase the fundamental capacity in the systems of these other countries so that at the end of the day, they can become independent and manage their own health challenges. Am I reading that right?
Exactly. No, that's our goal. And I will say to friends, colleagues, when I visit various countries, a measure of success of our efforts will be that I'm back visiting on vacation and I'll check in and see how you're doing.
Right.
Their goal needs to be building and maintaining their own health system. If we're smart about it from the beginning, we can help them help themselves.
And now, a word from Arch Street Press. Created by a diverse group of chefs, nutritionists, and food activists, Mindful Eating for the Beloved Community offers strategies to rebuild the connections between diet, culture, faith, the environment, and community well-being, with a focus on the deep connection between mindful eating, social justice, and sustainability. Through powerful storytelling and thoughtful analysis, the essays in Mindful Eating for the Beloved Community explore the historical and cultural shifts that have affected the way we eat. These essays provide the starting points for conversations to help us reframe our relationship with food to allow for physical, emotional, and spiritual healing. With one seed empowered, many trees take root. We now return to David and David.
I've heard you talk about something that I think is just so important, and not just in the domain of public health, but to our whole future as a republic. And that is, I've heard you talk about the role of ethics and ethical reasoning in public health. We don't hear enough about that today, I don't think. Leaders talking about how ethics inform their leadership and their planning, their mission. And I'd love for you to share a little bit about how you see ethics and ethical reasoning at work in your organization and in public health today.
Yeah, thank you for asking. Well, we are, just you can tell by the nature of the work we do, we're a values-based kind of place. The fact that we want to help the poorest among us, that's values-driven. But you have to do it in a smart and ethical way. And there are unusual challenges that one faces. Even though your intentions may be well-placed and that you want to do good, you have to stop and have a deliberate, methodologically rigorous way of asking yourselves about what constitutes ethical behavior, what constitutes a correct and successful approach. When is it okay to operate under a high degree of uncertainty? When is it not? Just to have that baked into your organization and the way you manage things as a part of how you look at your work, we have found to be very important. So in the same way that any business today would want to have a strong project plan if they're going to invest in a new major activity and they want to have a manager of that project, we also have to have a strong ethical management, if you will. So a lot has happened, and I think most citizens would acknowledge, like, the whole field of bioethics, that now in the case of healthcare delivery here in the U.S. and in most the wealthier parts of the world, there are ethicists that consult with clinicians on tough decisions like the end of life, or do you do a transplant on a particular person? There are many different ethical issues that can get in the way. Or do you allow a person who's, for religious reason, says they don't want or won't accept a blood transfusion during surgery? As a healthcare provider, do you give that surgery or not? These are the kinds of ethical issues that get in front of people. Well, the same applies to the work we do in global health. Just because a group of people may be poor and not having legal representation or the strong education to engage in a good conversation about whether or not they want to accept the program you're bringing them, we have an obligation to, we believe, engage them in ways that assure that they have a voice in what is happening to them.
Right. So part of this is ethics, and the commitment to ethics is also about how you treat the partners and the clients that you're working with, and thinking about their outcomes and their role in it. I'm hearing that right. And I guess There's also always in medicine, but also in other fields, there's the role of examining unintended consequences and asking what could go wrong. Am I right about that?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So it raises questions like how much evidence do you need before you go to a larger scale with particular treatment intervention? We've confronted that in some of our work, like with our river blindness program. Turns out that there is one contraindication of using the Mectazan drug for treating people with the drug, and that is a co-infection if they have another parasitic infection called Loa Loa, and you could actually kill them. But unless you test for that infection, you wouldn't know that. So you have these obligations to be thorough. I know we don't have a lot of time, but very briefly, we are doing a program in partnership with the Emory Global Health Institute and the CDC, funded by the Gates Foundation, called CHAMPS, the Child Health and Mortality Prevention Surveillance Network. This is all about driving down preventable child deaths in very poor places with very high child mortality, and doing it by having scientifically rigorous data that to guide the interventions. Well, when you look at that program, there are many, many issues that get raised about asking permission from families who've, say, lost a child to have tissue specimens taken from the child so that we could study them. You don't have just an unmitigated right to do that. And so that means you have a sort of a sociocultural approach to working with a community, building trust, getting them involved, and having them want to be a part of this. We've also been involved in a very large trial of, based on our trachoma program, the antibody, azithromycin that Pfizer donates. We saw back maybe 10 years ago that the observation seemed to be that children treated with this drug were getting healthier. It wasn't just about preventing eye infections, but in fact, they were getting healthier and child mortality seemed to be going down. That led the Gates Foundation to do a controlled clinical trial. It's called a double-blinded controlled clinical trial in three countries. And the data from that trial was released in the last few months. And it's compelling, very compelling. It shows that we can get maybe as high as a 25% reduction in child mortality simply by giving medicine to a one-month-old baby. Then that raises questions. Well, should we do this now at large scale in many, many places? Do we have enough evidence to act? That's the ethics question. And there are a number of questions that the clinical trial was not designed to answer. So with all these questions being asked, do you move forward or not? Those have to be really thoughtful discussions. So this is where that field of ethics comes in.
So I want to, branching out a little bit from this, because you've raised it, and I know that one of the things our listeners will have to understand is that this is, in terms of impact, an incredible story about a very relatively small group of people having an enormous impact on world health. And that's because you are a catalyst, and that's because you really understand managing relationships. So, of course, we could probably talk about that for 6 hours, but I'd love it if you could share just one or two maybe principles that you've learned about effective collaboration in this domain. What are some things that you turn to as you're building these networks that have to span cultures and countries? What have you learned?
First and foremost is you have to understand that credit should be infinitely divisible. Your partners can and should get credit. In our case, if we are principally the convener, the builder of the partnerships, the partners and their partners are doing the work. Here we are, roughly 150 people in Atlanta, Georgia. 150 people did not alone treat 350 million around the world. We did it through a web of partners, and a network of partners. And those partners have their needs, wants and wishes that have to be respected and understood. So as the convener and the secretariat, if you will, which is often our role, we should be the last ones who seek any kind of credit. sort of explains why very few people have ever heard of us. But that's on purpose, because if that's what it takes to make the partnerships impactful, then that's what it takes. I think another element of this is just genuine respect, willingness to know and respect and value all of those partners, which means understanding them, their cultures, their languages, their traditions. That takes time, and it takes work together to actually build the trust. And I think one other thing I would say, it's about measured results. The thing that holds these partnerships together over a long period of time, which is what's required to get to the end impact of eliminating a disease on the face of the earth, is that you have worked together and trusted one another, but you see progress being made. Well, to make progress, you have to measure it. And this is where I think the move to innovation using technologies from the most primitive to the most sophisticated, but using technologies that produce facts. And the facts together are indisputable. It tells us all whether we're making progress or not. And it builds the trust that together we're willing to look at how we're doing so that we can do better.
I'm so glad you mentioned that last thing, because to me it ties in also, that really is where you tie in integrity, that this is real and serious. And if you're not serious about measuring something, then you may not be serious about doing it. It's another example of great work that should be a model for other things that are going right and in many cases going wrong in our culture. But I'll just sort of summarize that. I heard you say sharing the credit, building authentic relationships based on trust, where you take the time to get to know one another, and then really having the integrity to hold one another accountable to measurable outcomes.
Well said.
Such terrific advice. So I have two more questions. We are coming toward the end of our time. One is about the future. I would be remiss if I didn't ask somebody who's got your experience and perspective. What do you see as the future, and I'm really in two domains. What excites you? Where do you feel a sense of optimism? And what do you wake up in the middle of the night worried about?
What excites me? I think I look at the impact we currently have, the footprint we have around the world, and I have to believe that that is a point for real expansion and leverage for doing good. And I can see that we have the opportunity to look where our expert convening platform can actually help. Because the reality is most big problems take multiple parties to solve. There are very few silver bullet problems in this world. Very few opportunities for one person or one group to have one answer to make and have that solve a problem. So the kinds of problems that would impact the health of people around the world are problems that many people have to come together and work together on. So I think at least we have experience that can inform the actions of others, if not be an outright help. So that's, to me, a point of optimism. On the fear side, the world has shrunk. The Thomas Friedman, the world is flat comment. We are living in a society where none of us is more than 36 hours away from anybody else in the world, which means all sorts of what used to be very remote threats are now threats to health everywhere. So the notion of global health security and investing in global health security, I think, is critical for everybody and certainly for the United States. I hope we don't walk away from that responsibility. It's also more than just it's not just a moral responsibility. It's actually a smart business responsibility to help stop diseases where they start, wherever that is, whether it's in our own backyard or in another continent.
And we've certainly seen some of that work in connection with Ebola and some of the deadly flu strains. I think it is fascinating that what you said is true, that our global connections are assets and they are also potential liabilities at the same time. We live in strange times.
Yeah, we do. So we have to worry about things like flu pandemics. That's why we have our partnership for influenza vaccine introduction program. It's a partnership with CDC and WHO. And we don't need another 1918 flu pandemic where, 40 million people die.
Right. Yes, you and others will be there to help stop that. I want to, as a final point, we always ask our guests this question, which is, we have a lot of people who listen to our program who are early stage social entrepreneurs. They may be coming out of school, very idealistic, community-minded, interested in making a difference. And when they look into successful organizations, one of the things that worries me is that they often see people who look like they've had enormous success, and they don't see the problems that those people have encountered along the way. Those are no longer visible. So I like to say that if we were watching a sports tape, we edited out all the air balls, and all we saw was the amazing highlight tape. So with a little bit of realism about how to be resilient, you know, how to maybe work through challenges, what advice would you give to somebody starting out early in their career who wants to end up making a significant difference?
A couple of things. One is, it does take persistence. If you discover that you have a particular passion and you want to move towards working in that area of your passion, don't give up. Be persistent. Expect to fail. One of the things I learned as a kid, I was brought up in the world of Golden Glove boxing, is sometimes you get knocked down. And the best thing you do is try to get back up and continue the fight. So persistence really would matter. Another thing that I've learned is, it took me some time to learn that the basic concepts that a business person would call the elements of a business plan are a wonderful thing to have regardless of what you're doing, but to really pull back and take a hard look, an honest look at what it's going to take to succeed, and ask yourself how you're going to pull together those various components. That can be very daunting, and I still would say be persistent, but don't be foolish.
Right. So planning and making sure that when your plans went into trouble, you have the fortitude, the grit to continue. These are lifelong lessons. Yes, yes.
Yeah. If it's a worthy goal that you seek and you're passionate about it, you may well find a way.
That's fantastic. Tell us, if we have listeners that want to support your work, where's the best place to continue to learn about what you're doing and to find you on the web? The website is
www.taskforce.org. And if you come to our homepage, it will give you the opportunity to drill into all of our various programs, learn more about them. And every one of those programs has very extensive websites themselves. So be prepared to enter the rabbit hole. But there's a lot you can gain and learn by investigating our site and sites. Also, if people are so inclined and would love to donate, we are a charitable organization. We appreciate any donations people want to make, and that's made possible visiting our homepage. And if you want more information, contact us directly. We'd be happy to talk.
Terrific. Dr. Ross, I want to thank you so much for the work that you guys are doing there. It's obviously making an enormous difference, and thank you for giving us your time today to talk about it. We really appreciate it.
Well, Dan, thanks for taking your time and having me talk with you. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for joining us today. Our library of interviews and a range of further resources are available at our website, innovatepodcast.org. Innovate is produced in partnership with Ashoka, Innovators for the Public, the Kellogg Fellows Leadership Alliance, the Philadelphia Social Innovations Journal, and by Arch Street Press. For PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, this has been Innovate.